When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Talk.
Street Talk.
Mike Graham.
Fighting the good fight with all his might. Providing a welcome dose of common sense for the common people.
Solid Talk.
Hot Talk.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham.
On the app, on your smart speaker, Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. It is a big day here on Talk TV and it's a big day down in the House of Commons as well. Boris Johnson and the Boris fight back is going to be happening from about 2 o'clock this afternoon. And we'll bring it all to you live and uncut right here on Talk TV, the only place to be, the home of common sense, the place where you hear the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. Well, you'll certainly get an attempt at that from Boris Johnson this afternoon. He's up before the Privileges Committee, of course. We'll be talking to Trevor Kavanagh, political columnist at The Sun, of course, former political editor, about that, plus a great many other things. Let's not forget, there are other political stories on the way, though. Front page of Daily Telegraph today, Sir Keir Starmer accused of hypocrisy because he's allowed to avoid tax on the pension he gets from when he was at the DPP. Well, heaven forfend. What do you mean? A hypocritical socialist? Are you having a laugh? I can barely believe it. We'll be talking about that. We'll also be talking, of course, about historic RAF Scampton this morning. Trevor's got an interest in it as well. An awful lot of people, the great and the good as well, raising the alarm about turning the former Dambusters RAF base into a home for illegal migrants. By the way, the cost of that is said to be something in the region, not of this particular project, but overall, over the next few years, £9 billion. To sort out the migrant crisis. It's very possible that Rishi Sunak is having a meeting with the Albanian Prime Minister a little bit later on. We'll find out more about that. Bill Wiggin MP is going to join us. He's going to be telling us what he makes of the Rwanda proposal. Also, another big name on the show coming up just after the first hour, Alex Salmond, the former First Minister of Scotland, former SNP leader, of course. He's now the leader of the ALBA party. As Scotland and the SNP's independence dream seems to be shattering before our very eyes, we'll get Alex Salmond's view on what's going on inside the SNP. And it's also 3 years to this week that he was cleared of all charges in a case that was brought by many people who thought it was engineered by certain members of the SNP. They all seem to have become vanquished and he's still here, so we'll find out what he's all about as well. Prime Minister's questions, as if that wasn't enough, is also coming up at midday. There's loads going on and we want to hear from you. And aside from anything else, they're bringing the Ford Capri back, but sacré bleu, it's not going to have an engine. No, it's going to be electric. Oh, my God. Anyway, we'll talk about that as well. 0344 499 1000 is the number. This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. Let's get it on. Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Lots of people talking about Boris Johnson and the Privileges Committee and what is going to be happening this afternoon, whether or not he misled Parliament, whether or not he did it deliberately, whether or not he did it recklessly. I've been saying for quite a long time, I think it's a bit of a witch hunt and I don't think we should be spending public money on it, to be honest. And the fact that people are getting all sort of worked up about it seems to me to be rather ridiculous. So let's kick things off with Trevor Kavanagh and talk about the hypocrite Keir Starmer instead. Hello, Trevor. How are you doing?
Hi, Mike.
Well, obviously, we will get to Boris Johnson, but let's not forget, this is not the most important story in the political landscape at the moment. There's far more important things going on with budgets, with inflation, with the migrant crisis. And here on the front page, just to distract us from the Daily Telegraph, is an amazing story about Sir Keir Starmer, who apparently has a tax break in his kind of in his home economics lesson, where he's apparently got savings that he got from the time that he spent at the Department of Public Prosecutions as the head of the DPP, and he can avoid paying tax on them because of some loophole.
Yes, it's wonderful. There's a great strike by The Telegraph, I think, today, because they've unearthed something which really does expose what is seen now increasingly as a thread of hypocrisy through just about everything that Keir Starmer stands for. And I think that's beginning to hit the Labour Party too. The polls are showing for the first time that Rishi Sunak is outpolling Keir Starmer in terms of plausibility, which is quite a big step in this situation as we approach an election. But in this particular case, Starmer and his team went to war against the budget on the basis that this was only for rich people, this measure, which gave them a chance to save more for their pensions. And then it turns out that a very carefully worded clause in his own pension contract with the DPP allowed him to do precisely the same thing up until 2013. Now, that really does smack as something which is the work of a hypocrite, does it not?
Well, it really does. And as Keir Starmer gets ever closer to what he believes is his opportunity to be Prime Minister, more of these stories will come out because, you know, here we have a man who was very successful in a career as a lawyer, a highly paid civil servant. He's finally decided he wants to be leader of the Labour Party. That's all fine and good. But, you know, this is a man who is about as out of touch with the working people of this country as anybody could ever be. And I'm sure that if he thinks he's going to be a shoo-in to be Prime Minister, the more these stories emerge, that he's a champagne socialist who lives in North London, the more likely it is that he's going to not get the job.
Well, I think we've discussed this before, Mike, and I've said that in recent weeks and months, Keir Starmer's rather slippery nature has been exposed to his enormous cost recently. Yeah. They've gone from 20 points in the polls down to 10 or 11. And if that trend continues, then it's into hung parliament or even remotely, I admit, the outside chance of a Tory last minute victory, which is an astonishing situation. And frankly, I think it's all down to the way people perceive the too many. Rishi Sunak is seen as at least straight and Keir Starmer increasingly as a little bit of a shabby two-faced person.
Yes. Well, all you've got to do is look at the way he treats his former leader, Jeremy Corbyn. You know, I mean, I would have more respect for him if he had at the time resigned from Corbyn's shadow cabinet, said, I cannot work with this man. He clearly has problems with anti-Semitism, whether it's true or not. He now says that he can't allow him to stand as a Labour candidate. But he was all for Jeremy Corbyn becoming Prime Minister of this country and all for being pictured with him, smiling, with his arms round him, you know, absolutely happy to project an image that they were very much on the same page. And, you know, he can't just suddenly now turn around and go, well, I always knew there was something dodgy about him.
That's right. And I think it's going to be very, very difficult for him to shrug that reputation off as someone who says one thing and does entirely the other. I mean, it wasn't just for the run-up to the election. It was over several years that he was working assiduously to have a Corbyn-led hard-left government elected. So this is something that he's tried to say, well, you know, basically I'm loyal to my leader. But loyal to what sort of leader? A man who embraces all sorts of extremism throughout the entire political career.
Yeah, which he now admits that he did. And yet he doesn't say at the time, I wish I'd done something differently. He still kind of just glosses over it whenever he's asked.
No, and I think the electorate is aware of this increasingly. They're beginning to look at him very much askance in terms of a potential prime minister.
I mean, very much a man who won't answer a straight question. It took him a very long time to even admit that there was such a thing as a woman, and he only managed to do it because his daughter quite liked the fact that the England women's football team had won the Euros. He still won't answer it if you ask him it in a straight interview one-on-one. The other question he won't answer is when he first started talking to Sue Gray, you know, whose name is going to be mentioned, I'm sure, many times this afternoon in the grilling that Boris is going to get in front of the Privileges Committee. You know, we saw a story at the weekend that suggested that Sue Gray was still working on the investigation inside Downing Street of Partygate when she started talking to the head of the Labour Party.
Yes, this is way back in October. Mm. And I mean, the record and reputation of Sue Gray up until this point was unimpeachable. But the more that becomes known about her and her family's relationship with the Labour Party over many years, the shabbier it looks. And all of this, I think, adds to that question mark over Keir Starmer, over his process of making decisions and the way that he blurs the truth in a way that others have levelled at Boris.
Exactly right. Let's talk a bit about the Boris hearings, as they're going to be called this afternoon. Privileged Committee going to be asking him loads and loads of questions. It'll be the usual sort of inside the beltway type Westminster bubble politics, won't it? Because all they can really try to prove now, having seen that he's admitted that he misled Parliament, is whether he did it willfully, recklessly, and knowingly. And I think that's very hard to prove.
Well, I agree. And I think the whole country has moved on anyway since then. There are a lot of people who were very, very angry at the time that suitcases on wheels were being trundled into Downing Street and new fridges were being bought to accommodate the booze. People were vomiting into waste bins and so on.
Right.
But there's no evidence that Boris Johnson himself was part of that. And the very complicating factor about Downing Street at that time is that you had hundreds of people in a state of crisis trying to deal with the COVID emergency, working very closely all day long, and occasionally at the end of a long, hard working day, often 18 hours, some of them got together for various things, and they were the same people who had been in the pod, so to speak, where they'd been working with each other. So it's a blurred area. I think that the general public maybe have suspicions about Boris, but on this occasion, I think they're probably on his side.
Yes. And I see that ever loyal acolyte Dominic Cummings is offering to live tweet the Boris hearings. I mean, I can't imagine anything worse than having to sit around anywhere near Dominic Cummings in his basement while he writes these interminably long threads on Twitter all about what he knew and when he knew it and why he thinks now Boris is lying. I mean, so many people are so bored with all of this that they can't be bothered.
Well, that's right. And I also think that Dominic destroyed his own base by admitting in his interview with Laura Koonsberg a couple of years ago that he was out to actually torpedo this the prime minister that he helped to elect, Boris Johnson, within almost weeks of actually him becoming prime minister. So I think that there's the animus there that Boris points out to in his evidence is so abundantly clear that most people aren't going to really take what Dominic says on this one seriously.
Yeah, I think that is the absolute point. And I mean, far more important, I suppose, for Rishi Sunak is what I understand is happening perhaps later on today, and there may be some kind of announcement this week as a meeting with the Albanian Prime Minister, the Rwanda project, making sure that the migrant situation is once and for all at least begun to be dealt with. What's your view of what's happening there? We see a story today that says it could cost as much as £9 billion to continue to house the migrants that are coming in. I mean, they've got to find a way to stop them, haven't they?
Well, this is the issue, as you say, Mike, which is really dwarfs and completely overwhelms every other. Forget about Partygate and all that nonsense. People are absolutely exercised across the country about illegal immigration and the sight of people coming across in small boats and filling up our hotels and military bases and elsewhere at huge cost to them, the taxpayer. And they're not being assimilated, they're not being processed, and often they're completely illegal and we don't know what to do with them after they've arrived. So that is the thing that really does upset a lot of voters. Mm-hmm. And I think that to his credit, I think that Rishi Sunak and Suella Braverman are getting some positive reaction for a change for a Tory policy.
Yeah, absolutely right. Because people are getting sick to death of seeing local hotels in their areas getting commandeered. We're going to be hearing very shortly, coming up just after this little break, from the residents of Scampton, a little town which is home to the Dambusters RAF site, which is apparently being commandeered. But there's a massive revulsion at that from the people inside the town itself, because the town is only about 1,400 people, I think, and they're talking about putting 1,500 migrants in it. We'll come back to that. They've been demonstrating in Kegworth outside another hotel as well. I know you've been writing about this stuff, Trevor. We'll come back with Trevor Kavanagh after this. This is, of course, the only place to be. It's the only place to listen to common sense. I'm Mike Graham. This is The Independent Republic.
Nationwide, by your side, Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Welcome back to The Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. The story of RAF Scampton is one that we've mentioned in the past, but it's really beginning to hot up, this particular story. We're talking to Trevor Kavanagh, political columnist at The Sun, who's written about this as well. But basically, the plan was for a redevelopment of the former RAF Dambusters HQ. And the Red Arrows, of course, as well, were there at one time as well. It's in Lincolnshire. 617 Squadron departed for the legendary 1943 bouncing bomb raid against two Nazi dams in World War II. Local historians, various personalities from television have spoken up in favour of making the Dam Busters home some kind of historical site, rather than just selling it off to the nearest bidder so that it can house a bunch of illegal migrants who have come here by small boats across the channel. Let's just have a look at one of the local meetings that took place this week, and it's pretty hot-headed.
The men, all the ladies who gave their life for us all, even the people who agree with it. Yeah. Our history is getting thrown away for people who are illegal immigrants.
Yeah. And I think it's a crying shame if we are standing on the cusp of a £300 million deal to safeguard that heritage and commemorate all those that flew from there, died from there, at the same time as investing in the local community and improving skills and employment opportunities in the local area. It's criminal.
Do you want to say that on camera that you've offered me outside and you're going to deal with it?
Feelings running pretty high, and you can't really blame them. 1,400 people live in the town, or village, you might say. Quite a lot of them there turning out for a meeting, a couple of hundred people there. But Trevor, feelings running very high, not just in this particular part of the world, in Scampton, but all over the country. There was another demo that I saw in Kegworth last night. There's been demonstrations all over the place in different places where hotels are being commandeered. I mean, this is a real crisis now, isn't it?
It is, and to be fair, it's a crisis right across Europe, and it's causing enormous problems in countries which are very liberal, like Sweden and Denmark. But here in Britain, nothing more vividly demonstrates the clash between the interests of the ordinary British public, the taxpayers of this country, and people who have simply invited themselves in illegally across the Channel and set up home in this country without permission. And you have a situation in the RAF Scampton where only this month they won a regeneration deal which was worth £300 million to turn the 800-acre site into a new sort of museum, heritage site, but also a place where high-tech new jobs were being created for thousands of workers who, in an area where unemployment is really serious. I mean, this area of Britain is the fourth poorest in Europe. Mm. It needed this shot in the arm quite seriously, and suddenly it's snatched from under their eyes by the invasion of illegal 1,500 asylum seekers who have simply barged their way in.
Yeah, and I mean, they continue to do so, probably because they know that if they do manage to make it to shore, they'll never have to leave. And at the moment, that is the status quo. And I mean, I'm afraid I hear more and more lawyers on various different outlets, including our own, talking about what rights they have, how they must be able to be allowed to come here, how we must absolutely consider everybody who comes for asylum because it's our duty. I mean, I think surely all of these laws that were set up all the way back to the 1950s are not fit for purpose anymore. People are making fun of us. People are taking advantage of us. The people traffickers are making a fortune. You know, I don't understand anybody, particularly those kind of celebrity lefties, as we know them, who wants to defend it.
No, I think that RAF Scampton is an unusual case. And I think actually that the local campaigners will win this battle simply because this is the home of the Dam Busters, yeah, the Red Arrows and the Vulcan bombers that were used in the Falklands War. They've got a very strong case with that regeneration scheme. But this is happening, as you say, right across the country. Luxury four-star hotels are being commandeered and taken over, filled with migrants, with mostly young men who have nothing to do but prowl the streets and often find themselves unaccountably outside schools. So this is one of the problems that one of the things that I think are affecting the polls, in the sense that Suella Braverman and Rishi Sunak do seem to be absolutely determined to make the Rwanda program work. And all the indications are that it will work, that we will see plane loads of people being taken to Rwanda for processing and not able to come back again. Once that begins, we will see it as a serious discouragement, I think, to cross-channel people smugglers.
Yes, and that has to be the way forward, doesn't it? Because I think, as we've said before, it wasn't a deterrent when it wasn't actually operational. Once it is operational, and once it becomes clear that if you do land in Britain, you can't stay, I think they'll stop coming.
Yes, I think this is it's a different sort of system to Australia, but this is exactly what happened in Australia. Once the difficulties became substantial, the flow of migrants to Australia from countries like Pakistan and Indonesia and so on, and that dried up almost overnight. Well, it's not going to be quite that easy because they will still try to get across the channel on trucks and ferries and all sorts of other things. But it will be a huge deterrent to the boat people smugglers.
Yeah. Well, we were able to stop them smuggling themselves onto lorries because there were more stringent security measures put into place. I mean, it ended up meaning that you had to make Calais look sort of like a prison camp and put more fence wire up than you'd ever seen anywhere in the world. But it deterred them and it stopped them because the point about everything, and you know this as an ordinary citizen of the country, you know, if you leave your front door open, there's probably bigger chance that actually people are going to come in and rob from you than if you lock it every night.
Exactly. And I mean, what we've got at the moment is an open door policy in which is being taken advantage of at the rate of 45,000 a year. If you shut down that open, or if you shut that door, then you're going to cut the immigration rate to a trickle across the channel through other means. 45,000 a year is simply insupportable. We cannot accommodate, look after, or in any way absorb that sort of number for any length of time. And I think we're already full in that sense. Mm.
Exactly right. Finally, Trevor, today the Windsor framework faces a Commons vote, as if there's not enough going on out there. Some Tory rebels are saying they're not going to vote for it. Mark Francois, Boris Johnson himself, I think he's not going to vote for it. Do you see any problems with this going through in terms of whether the European Union thinks it's got a good deal out of this or whether it's going to all unravel?
Well, I think that it's going to get through simply because the Labour Party will support it. But there will be obviously rebels on the right wing and Marc Francois. I'm not sure about Jacob Rees-Mogg. He seems to be mulling his position on that. But I think that there are sufficient numbers of Brexiteers, David Davison among them, who have supported this measure for them to get it through and hold on. I mean, I have my reservations, and I guess you do too, about the question of the European Parliament and the ECHR, the rights of all of the hold that the European Union still has over this, and in fact, quite defiantly insists that it does. Mm. I mean, they're not making any secret of that. So it's with some sort of discomfort that I would say we have to grab what we can out of this and make the best of it.
Yeah. And I mean, the worry I suppose people do have is that it means that there is still always a slight kind of trapdoor or a way back, if you like, if anybody in the Labour Party suddenly was to get into power and go, oh, I know, let's get a bit closer to the single market. Let's get a bit closer to, you know, trade agreements. Let's get a bit more of the EU back in, as it were.
Yes. And I'm absolutely sure that under Keir Starmer, that's exactly what would happen. So, yes, there are good grounds for feeling sympathetic towards the people like Marc Francois, who say that this is not watertight.
Yes.
And but the DUP, interestingly, is not rejecting it out of hand. It's rejecting it, but with reservations about the possibility of further negotiation. So all is not lost.
Yes, indeed. Good to talk to you, Trevor Kavanagh. Thank you very much indeed, Trevor Kavanagh, columnist, of course, at The Sun, former political editor as well. Like me, saying, the biggest story in town is not Boris Johnson. The biggest tale in town is nothing to do with Partygate. I know some of you differ from that, but I'm telling you, this is all about a witch hunt on Boris Johnson. Mark from Sunbury does disagree. He says Boris will not have his life ruined by what happens to him today, unlike the people whose lives he ruined and fined with pointless lockdown rules and fines. Prison for Boris and compensation for us, the people who were treated like slaves. Well, what I'd say about that, Mark, is that some people were forced into situations they should never have been forced into. But those are the conversations I'd like to have, not about whether he had a party, whether he attended a party, whether he had a bit of cake, whether he had a glass of water or a glass of scotch. These are all niceties that are all about attacking Boris Johnson, which is not the story. The story is, what did this government do to all of us, and why were we involved in listening to somebody who was the chief medical officer of this country, a man by the name of Chris Whitty, who told us all at the beginning hardly anybody's going to be damaged by COVID, and then turned it into the biggest lockdown you've ever seen in the history of Britain? That's the question I want to have answered. I don't care about Boris Johnson's activities in Downing Street. I do care about the policies, why they were made, who made them, and why we are still not getting any answers out of any inquiry that's being held. So far, the only answers we've had are out of Matt Hancock's WhatsApp messages. This is Talk TV. Coming next, we're going live to College Green. Bill Wiggin, MP, is going to be telling us why we should be paying 9 billion quid for the migrants. This is Talk TV. Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Much to do today. We've got PMQs coming up at midday. Of course, we've got Alex Salmond coming up at 11 o'clock. He's going to give us the latest from Scotland on the stramash, as they call it up there, and the nastiness going on. And that's just the infighting between the SNP and the three leadership candidates. It really is quite an extraordinary state of affairs. Terrible business if you want independence in Scotland, which, of course, I don't. But it's all falling apart. We'll see what Alex Salmond has to say for it. Let's talk to Bill Wiggin now, though, a Conservative MP for North Herefordshire. He's live with us right here on College Green outside Parliament. Bill, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike. It's great to be on your show again, and I'm delighted to be able to talk about the Refugee Council.
Yes, absolutely
who
right.
I think... So these are the people that have been telling everybody, if they are listening, that the government's plans won't work. So today they've thought of an enormous figure and tried to frighten people into thinking that if the government puts these plans in place, we'll all be swamped and the bills will be massive and it's all doom and gloom. And I'm just here to say they're wrong.
Excellent. Well, this is why we want to have you on the show, Bill, because, you know, we only deal in the truth here at the Independent Republic. And what we don't want is people making up fanciful numbers, sticking a few zeros on and telling us that's what's going to be the case. But we do have a problem financially at the moment, because we are paying currently somewhere between £6 and £7 million a day to house these people. So a lot of people are asking me, what is the truth about the Rwanda plan? Can we send hundreds there? Can we send thousands? You know, what is that all going to be like? And are we going to be in receipt of hundreds and thousands of Rwandan refugees coming the other way?
Well, I don't think that's the case. The answer to the hundreds is yes, we can send hundreds. Can we send thousands? The Home Secretary says yes, we can. She was in Rwanda last week, as you know, and therefore I have no reason to disbelieve her. I think she's doing a fantastic job. And this is a very, very difficult challenge because people are looking across the channel, people from all over the world, thinking if I get in a rubber dinghy, I'll turn up in the UK, I'll get a free house, free healthcare, free education, and it's going to be absolutely brilliant. And that sucker, the British taxpayer, is going to pick up the bill. And that's why I'm in Westminster to try and stop that, because I know my constituents want better healthcare. They want their government to manage the borders, to take back control. And that's why I totally support what Rishi Sunak has been doing. He's put that bill before the House, and it's going to be up to the House of Lords to get it through, or else I think we'll have to do a Parliament Act motion to ensure that they can't stop it.
Yes.
Because what you said about the daily bill is outrageous. You know, we want to process people who need asylum, who are in fear for their lives, quickly, efficiently and generously. And we can't do that if we have 140,000 to 160,000 people blocking up the system, claiming they've been trafficked when they haven't, claiming they are all sorts of things that turn out not to be the case. And that really is stealing from those who need that asylum process.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, because we're hearing stories all the time now from various lawyers, many of whom are in receipt of large amounts of money from the legal aid pot to keep these people coming. And basically, they say, oh, well, they've all got relatives here. Well, how do we know that? Well, how do we know if they're members of the same family? Yeah, how do we know whether or not the people who are supposedly paying human traffickers to bring people here should not be arrested? If that's what's happening, if people are sending money to human traffickers to bring their relatives here, surely that's an offence, isn't it?
I think the whole thing is wrong. And I think it's the lawyers who are really standing the most to lose after the people traffickers when this legislation finishes its process and becomes law.
Mm.
We all want a generous process and system to be available. And I think that gets lost in the anger that the broken system is creating. And when you hear that the civil service are processing one applicant a week,
Yeah. You
know, that says it all for me. Those civil servants have not got the right guidelines if that's how long it takes. And again, Suella has stepped in and said, look, it takes you 6 hours to interview someone because you have to translate it, you have to check it. We don't need to do this more than once.
Yeah.
Currently, I think they're doing it twice or even more. Right. So there's a lot of streamlining that needs to happen in order to provide that hospitality that we want and to weed out the people who are gaming a system and providing money for illegal activity.
Well, exactly. Well,
you know, if you want to come to my country, behave yourself. Well, don't break the law.
Yeah, also, and identify yourself, please, rather than pretending to be somebody that you're not or coming from somewhere where you didn't come from. But again, the lawyers are helping them with all of this because they know how to gain, as you say, the system. You know, they can't have it both ways. They can't say, well, one of the reasons a lot of these people come here rather than staying in France is because they have English as a second language. And then we get told, oh, well, they can't understand us. They have to get an interpreter. We can't. It can't be both things. Can't be true, can they? And the second part about all of that is that we're told all the time, oh, 80% of people who come here to seek asylum eventually get it. Well, that's because they're here so long that they qualify to get it, or they qualify on one of the spurious means that they know they can say in order to get it. Like if they get sent home, they might face torture. My favourite being the Iranian rapist who can't be sent home because he might be put to death for being a rapist. So it's all right for us to keep him here.
Yeah, and you know, people listening to this might get very angry and they might want to protest. And it's worth bearing in mind that some of these people are the real deal. They're genuine, they need our help. And that gets lost. And it's really important to keep bringing the narrative back to remember why we allow asylum in the first place. It isn't to harbour rapists from abroad. It's for people who are genuinely in fear for their life, such as judges who, under the Afghan regime, were helping us to make sure that justice was delivered for Afghan people who are now being hunted down by the Taliban. And you know, we've got a great case to say, look what we've done for Ukraine. We've taken lots of Ukrainians. We've made them incredibly welcome. We think they're great. We admire their bravery. And we completely understand why, if you're fighting the Russians, you might want your wife and children to be safe in the UK. Mm. So we've got a good story to tell. There are safe ways to get to the UK. There is a welcome for the genuine asylum seeker. But if you're thinking of gaming it, playing a system, trying to get something for nothing, please don't get in that rubber dinghy. It's not worth it. You will end up in Rwanda.
Yeah. And what about the backbench MPs? I don't know if you're involved in this, who might be pressing on Wednesday an amendment to the bill, which would sort of effectively bypass any decision or judgment from the European Court of Human Rights. We're told that might be something that's happening.
Yes, I think that's the right job for MPs to do. It is our role in Parliament to debate all the options the government has. And that may mean moving an amendment. If that's the case, then we'll consider the amendment, listen to the arguments and vote on it accordingly. But I think it's better we do that on the floor of the House than it's done by the same civil servants who are spending a week trying to process one claim.
Yeah, well, I think that tells you more about the civil services than it does about anything else, I'm afraid. I wonder what they would happen if they went on a go slow. I'm old enough to remember when people did that. Don't think you can go any slower, can you? But let's have a final chat about...
They went on strike a few days ago, didn't they?
Well, they did, yeah.
I'm not sure anyone noticed.
No, nobody noticed. In fact, so, when Border Force go on strike, it's actually you stop more people coming in. But that's another story. Finally, Boris Johnson this afternoon, the four-hour sideshow, I'm calling it. I think it's a waste of public money, a waste of time. I think most people certainly listening to this show and watching it agree with me. Of course, people are angry that not everything was done the right way inside of Downing Street. But is...
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
isn't this a bit of a waste of public office, public money and public time?
Well, I think the problem for all of us is, how do you prove intent? And the question hanging over Boris is, did he intentionally mislead the House? He has provided lots of evidence saying that he tried to do the right thing. But there is a huge school of opposition who want to see him go down. And this is their opportunity to try and have a go at him. I'm not convinced that the evidence that he deliberately, willfully and dishonestly misled the House is there. But it is up to the committee to decide that and to make a report to the House. And until we've seen that final report, it is a matter of speculation.
Mm.
But at the end of the day, I felt really let down by Sue Gray, who turned out to be a passionate Labour supporter.
Yeah.
And I think that legacy of opportunity by the opposition is being built on today, and so we'll just have to see what happens.
Yeah, absolutely right. Bill, good to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Bill Wiggin, MP for North Herefordshire, talking to us live there from College Green. We'll be back, of course, in Westminster and back on College Green in the 12 hour. At midday, it's time for Prime Minister's questions. And then, of course, after that, we'll be talking to Jonathan Gullis, MP, about his thoughts on not only the migrant situation, but also on what is to come this afternoon. Don't forget, you can watch it all live right here on Talk TV, should you wish to. I'm not sure you'll be able to get through all 4 hours of it, though. 0344 499 1000 is the number. This is Talk TV.
On the app, on your smart speaker, Talk Radio and Talk TV.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. It is, of course, a very big day for Westminster politics today. We've got the return of Boris Johnson. He's going to be in the chamber for the first time in a while. He hasn't really been seen that much around the House of Commons lately, but he's going to be obviously quizzed in front of the Privileges Committee inside the House of Commons later on. He's going to be giving answers as to whether he lied, whether he told any untruths, whether he deliberately misled Parliament, and whether, in fact, he should be suspended as a result of that. He's already admitted that he misled Parliament, but whether it was officially something he did deliberately, whether it was something he did recklessly, will appear to be the charge at hand. And of course, we've got 4 hours of footage to show you here at Talk TV. We will offer you all of that, but we may not bring you all of it because, of course, it may not be that interesting. In my view, it's a waste of public money. I'd rather know far more about the inside workings of politics and the inside workings of government during the COVID pandemic, to wit, some of the stuff that Matt Hancock was getting onto, some of the things that Chris Whitty was suggesting, some of the models that we were being told about. One, of course, was that Nicola Sturgeon thought mask wearing was a good idea, and so everybody in Downing Street went, right, we better do that then. Of course, Nicola Sturgeon, soon to become a footnote in the history of the independence movement in Scotland. We're about to speak now to Alex Salmond, former First Minister of Scotland, leader of the ALBA party, because there was yet another hustings last night. Times Radio organised one for the three contenders to be the new leader of the SNP, the new First Minister, Humza Yousaf, Kate Forbes and Ash Regan, all slagging off Nicola Sturgeon now because the edifice of the SNP has simply fallen away in a quite dramatic style in the past week or so. Let's talk to Alex and find out what's going on. Alex, a very good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
Thank you very much.
I just say, I was asked to come on a programme called Independent Republic, and I just said to myself, that's for me.
Yeah, well, exactly right. I mean, I'm of course independent of everything. You know, I'm not neither part of the United Kingdom nor part of Scotland, England, Northern Ireland, Wales. I rest myself somewhere offshore so that I can be completely neutral in these matters. But I mean, I have to say, some of the things that have been going on inside the SNP beggar belief. You know, people have said to me there are things that are going to come out which could be quite shocking. Has that process begun? I mean, we've seen the end of Nicola Sturgeon. We've seen the end of Peter Murrell. Murray Foot, the guy who was behind all the press, has gone as well. What's going on?
Well, there's certainly quite a few bodies floating down the river, not over the last few days. In fact, the person who's been brought in as acting chief executive, brought back from the political twilight, Mike Russell, somebody, incidentally, I appointed in 19 Oakcake to be chief executive a long time ago. He's described it as a boorach, which is a Scots Gaelic word, which, it doesn't just mean a mess. It means a total, absolute, calamitous disaster.
I think we'd call it a Horlicks down here, wouldn't we?
It's a boorach, yes.
It really is. And I mean, they're all sort of running for cover, like fighting like rats in a sack. They can't seem to agree really now on anything. But what they can seemingly say altogether is that it has been run badly, the SNP. I mean, I don't wish to blow smoke over you. But I mean, since you left and since, I mean, we say 3 years ago to the week that you were acquitted of all those charges that were laid against you. The people that seem to have been behind all of that are sort of falling away at a rate of knots.
Well, I mean, certainly the SNP, as we now know, because the point of resignation of Murray Foote and Peter Murrow was when it was discovered they'd been lying about the membership. Mm. I mean, not just lying by a factor of 100 or 1,000, but lying by a factor of 30,000.
Right.
Now, Murray Foote says it wasn't him, he was given the wrong information. Peter Murrow says he didn't intend to mislead, but he's going to resign anyway. But obviously there was a systematic lie about the membership. And the importance of that, of course, it's not just like political parties doing their normal bit of exaggeration, is you're in an election campaign to be First Minister of Scotland. You know, that's not an inconsiderable thing.
Mm.
And the very least that the three candidates are entitled to when they're competing to be First Minister is to know the size of the electorate. Not to get told at the start of the contest it was 100,000,
yeah,
and then two-thirds of the way through, oops, it's only 70,000.
Right.
So it's not a small thing, this. And it does tend to indicate there's a, how shall I put it, a cultural problem in the recent modern SNP, a problem of consistent deception.
Yes, and there does seem to be a situation going on where very few people, even in the highest echelons of what would be the Scottish Government, actually were privy to what was going on, to what decisions were being made. It's almost as though Peter Murrell and Nicola Sturgeon and a very small cabal around them were making all the decisions.
Well, let's take the matter away from the three candidates. Incidentally, I thought in the last couple of debates they're starting to emerge much better than at the start of the contest. I think all three of them, and I think particularly the two women candidates,
yeah,
actually come across very well last night in the Times debate, for example.
Mm.
But I was interested in the comments of John Nicholson, the SNP MP yesterday. Now, he's a, well, how shall I put it nicely for John? He hasn't been the most critical of the of the SNP leadership.
Right.
Some people might say to the extent of fawning over recent years. But yesterday, of course, he was now felt free to let loose and was saying that the real problem was that there was such a narrow focus of decision-making. They hadn't been listening to expert advice. The subtext was they hadn't been listening to John Nicholson, probably.
Yes.
But nonetheless,
right,
he actually has managed to, after all these years as a parliamentarian, a light on a very serious point. And that undoubtedly was one of the difficulties, just one of the difficulties that the SNP have been suffering from.
Yes. And people are now writing openly that basically the independence movement has been severely damaged by this latest kind of stramash, which is what I'm calling it. Another, it's a nice Scottish word that I quite like. Because independence seems to have been forgotten about because, you know, during COVID, and of course everybody will give certain people a bit of rope because it was a pandemic and nobody was quite sure what was going on. But it seemed as though Nicola Sturgeon, and I don't want to make this all about her, became absolutely sort of enthralled with her own importance and became, and we've just heard from Jason Leach that, you know, it might have been a mistake to shut the schools. You know, it's all of it's unravelling.
Yeah, I mean, I like the word stramash. This was a word made famous by the late Arthur Monford, a
right,
very famous Scottish.
He was a friend of my dad's, funnily enough. He used to play golf with
commentator
him.
Commentator who used to describe goalmouth incidents as stramashes,
yes,
in the goalmouth. So you didn't entirely waste your time in Scotland.
No.
But yes, it has been a stramash, and certainly there's been an element of damage. But you have to beware of, and this is not addressed to you, Mike, because you served your time at the coalface in Scotland.
Yeah.
You know the issues much better than many London commentators.
Yes.
And I think there's some ancestral ties to Scotland as well.
Mm.
But you do get network London commentators who cannot hide their glee that, you know, that this might mean that the national movement in Scotland is dead and buried, that,
yeah,
these pest Scots are, you know, they've rid themselves of these turbulent Scots.
Right.
I think they're entirely misreading the situation. Yes, of course, problems in the leading independence party do represent problems for the independence movement. But the independence movement is by far the most powerful force in Scottish politics. And if you look over the medium term as opposed to very short term factors, then you can see that it's growing and probably growing irresistibly because of the generational changes as Scotland has developed. So I think the London commentators who think, well, my goodness, we've seen the last of this independence nonsense, they're vastly... I mean, I think that complacency is to be welcomed, incidentally, because next time independence roars back, they'll be caught by surprise.
Yeah, no, I don't think by any means that it's disappeared. I mean, I'm just saying that I think it has been dealt a blow, because it was only seemingly, I think, within the last few months that Nicola Sturgeon was trying to get a second referendum through the Supreme Court in London. When she failed, as she must have known she would, she said, well, the next election will then be, for me, a sort of de facto independence referendum, because she knew she would win the next election, because the SNP probably will, even despite all of this. But, you know, it just seems to have set it all back a bit, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, Nicola drove up a cul-de-sac last year by going to the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom to ask for advice on how to dissolve the United Kingdom. Now, you wouldn't have to be a legal genius to suggest that perhaps the right people to ask for advice on how to dissolve the United Kingdom is not to ask an institution whose entire existence is about the United Kingdom. I mean, no, it's like going to the BBC to ask for advice on independence campaigning tactics.
Yes.
And, you know, the name's on the tin. It's the British Broadcasting Corporation. They don't intrinsically like the idea of Scottish independence, despite the, you know, they always say they're impartial and all the rest of it. But we actually know that's not true. So that indication, going to the Supreme Court, was a huge misstep. And, you know, normally Nicola Sturgeon was a very sure-footed politician, a very cautious politician in many ways. And that was a sign that things were going off the rails. And then, of course, we went into the whole transgender reform debate, where somebody of, you know, substantial communication skills like Nicola Sturgeon has, you know, is totally unable to describe a man pretending to be a woman to get into a female prison, who's a double rapist, as anything other than what he was.
Yeah.
And when you become... I mean, the problem with that, of course, is there was a number of interviews where commentators, particularly London commentators, for the very first time started to laugh at the Scottish First Minister. And I mean, you can have people who are your opponents, you know, fearing you, criticising you, attacking you, trying to run you down. But one thing you mustn't have is ridicule. Mm. And how Nicola got herself into the position of not being able to articulate that, you know, if you have a policy position that even a master of communications can't articulate, it might be a clue it's the wrong policy position.
Yes. I mean, a lot of people also say that her coalition with Patrick Harvey and the Green Party was not the wisest decision that she had made either, because that was kind of where all that gender stuff started. Some have said that if Kate Forbes becomes the leader, that might all disappear and the Greens might no longer be part of all of that. What are you hearing about that situation?
Well, I mean, certainly there is an argument that many of the Scottish government's difficulties over recent months had a green tinge to them. You know, there were, let's put it this way, there were green fingers all over them, not just the transgender debate, but the alienation of oil and gas workers and the northeast of Scotland, the fairly ridiculous deposit return scheme for bottles and cans. Incidentally, an idea that probably everybody supports in principle, thinks is a good idea, but you really got to have some inkling that you can put it forward in practice if you're going to introduce it. And when they were, and probably also the duelling of the A9. Don't underrate that. I mean, that was a historic promise made by the SNP, made by my administration back in 2007 first, and carried forward and suddenly, well, not suddenly abandoned, progressively abandoned. And, you know, a lot of people in the Highlands felt deeply upset. And it just, I think it's more than a coincidence that the, you know, the Green Party don't really want to build any roads anywhere, anytime, let them go anywhere, even if they're in electric vehicles, which they should be.
No, indeed. Well, they'd rather they just let them grow over, I think. I think that's what they prefer. And what about your own situation? I mean, is this an opportunity for Alba to become a bigger force? I mean, I know you were asked way back when you and I first met up again over in the TV studios that, you know, would you sort of, you know, join together and lead an independence movement as such? Are people still asking you that question? Is the answer still that you don't really want to be the leader of it?
Well, I mean, the SNP is the predominant independence party. I think ALAPA have a vital role to play To keep the independence flame burning when the SNP starts to go off and talk about other things. You know, I mean, as I put it, the SNP seem fascinated by self-identification and no longer interested in self-determination for Scotland.
Well, you might say they're not even self-identifying anymore as independence zealots.
Well, that is the problem. Now, a lot depends on the leadership election.
Yeah.
I don't share, incidentally, Hamza Yousaf is very sensitive about my comments. He thinks I shouldn't be commenting on who should be the next First Minister of Scotland. But actually, I'm not anything like as critical as many people have been. Because I think within these candidates, there is a lot of substance. I think Ash Reagan has put forward a very sensible, well-worked-out independence strategy, which the SNP clearly needs. I think Kate Forbes is a breath of fresh air in many ways. I mean, a naturally gifted young woman who is clearly, a substantial politician. And I think Hamza Yousaf, well, how shall I better put it so Hamza doesn't get upset again, is not as bad as people are saying. and in the Times debate last night, now, a lot will depend on what happens in the future as to the outcome of this election, whether the SNP decides it's going to offer the hand of friendship to not just other independence parties, but the whole variety of grassroots organisations and think tanks who have been basically shut out of decision-making. Whether there's going to be the hand of friendship through an independence convention where everybody can get together. Because if you're going to take on and beat the Westminster establishment, the first thing you should do is unite the independence forces so that we're all together taking on and beating the Westminster establishment. Mm. Or alternatively, if it's going to be just the recent history, the continuity SNP, and continuity, in the memorable words of one of the candidates in this election, won't cut it, because continuity has been leading to faltering, or at least static support for independence, a dramatic decline in SNP membership, and you cannot just go on like that. You have to have something new and better to offer. Now, if that better offer is an independence convention, then Alapa will be very proud to play our part, whatever that is, in that convention. And then, of course, that would also allow, this is a great benefit, the SNP politicians to get on with the job, which is really, really important, of running Scotland fairly, wisely, and above all, competently, if the independence campaign has been progressed through an independence convention.
Well, and how about in a transparent manner, which doesn't appear to have been going on much either, because a lot of people are concerned that this is not where it ends, that, in fact, Nicola Sturgeon, for some bizarre reason, I finished my show the other day, went outside the studio, and there she was on Loose Women, which I thought was an interesting place to go to make her case. But she claims, despite various suggestions, that she can't comment on any police investigation. That turned into some commentators saying, well, she says she hasn't heard from the police. She didn't actually say that. She said, I can't comment on any police investigations. I never have, and I never will. But, you know, there is certainly some kind of investigation going on, and that may mean that any continuity that you want to have from Nicola Sturgeon's era, you wouldn't actually want to have.
Yes, I think, how shall I put it, without impeding on... Saying, I'm not going to criticise Nicola Sturgeon for going on television programmes. I'm the last person in the world to criticise politicians for going on television programmes. But, look, without prejudicing any current inquiries... Mm. If I were standing for SNP leader and were successful at the present moment, which clearly I'm not, but if I were doing that and I was successfully elected, then I think the first thing I would do is bring a team of my own accountants into SNP headquarters. So there was a very clear demarcation line between the starting point of the new leader and what had gone before, because regardless of who's elected, I think the indications are they want to have that demarcation line, because no new leader wants to be burdened with the potential misdeeds of the past.
No, indeed. Absolutely. Well, it's a fascinating situation. We should keep our eyes on it, and we'll talk to you, I'm sure, again very soon, Alex, about it.
On Boris, Bestow, is he going to be unbound and free yet again?
I mean,
or is he going to ask for... I mean, Boris Johnson misleading Parliament. I mean, who would have thought that was possible? I think you should go in there and ask for another 100 offences to be taken into account. Get off with everything.
I mean, he's kind of, in true Boris fashion, he's sort of kiboshed the whole inquiry, because he's already admitted to doing it. So now that you've got to prove not that he did it, but that he meant to do it, which is a lot harder to do.
Yeah, well, you never know. I mean, it's not necessarily somebody to back against. But you see this whole Northern Irish thing, mate?
Yeah.
You know, here's an example of an opportunity for the SNP and the independence movement right now. I saw Trevor Kavanagh instilling a bit of mischief with you earlier on. I mean, you know, what Scotland should be saying right now is we'll go into the agreement as well.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe that would make the Democratic Unionists feel better if somebody else was in it. And then, of course, we would have, in Boris Johnson's famous words, the best of both worlds. Right. Access to the single market and preferred access to the market.
This is when I always say to people, you know, when people say about Rishi Sunak, he's a very clever man. Yeah, but he's not that clever because he actually announced himself to favour the best of both worlds, which was to be not only in the single market, but to be in the UK market as well. And everybody, of course, who voted to remain said, well, why can't we have that?
You're badly missed in Scotland.
Well, maybe I'll come up and do a tour. But listen, good to talk to you, Alex. We'll talk to you again soon, very soon, I'm sure. Alex Salmond, former First Minister of Scotland, leader, of course, of the Albert Party. There's some very, very weird going on up there, north of the border. We'll keep you informed, of course, at all times. This is the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. More coming up.
The home of common sense. Talk radio and talk TV.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk TV. Coming up at midday, it is, of course, Prime Minister's Questions with Sir Keir Starmer, who this morning has been labelled a hypocrite by the Daily Telegraph because he apparently has managed to avoid paying tax on a pension that he's receiving from his time at the DPP. It's all right for some. This is a man who was moaning on about how the new pension policy from the Tory party in the budget by Jeremy Hunt last week will only help the wealthy. Well, of course, he's one of them. Of course, it helps the wealthy. But he had the same help back in 2013, and he's now being labelled a hypocrite. And why wouldn't you be? Also, lots more to come, of course, in the next hour as well. And this afternoon, the Boris hearings, Partygate, all over the place. Right now, though, we're going to speak to Mark Morrell, a.k.a. Mr. Pothole, on the appalling state of Britain's roads. He's actually said that we will need to be spending billions and billions and billions and billions and billions of pounds to actually fix the roads in Britain, which have literally gone to pot. And he says there's plenty of money available to do it. Mr. Pothole, Mark, very good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike.
Thanks very much. I mean, you managed to get yourself not only onto the front page of The Sun yesterday, but you've got a big piece in the paper today as well. What is the problem and why is it getting worse?
Decades of underinvestment. I published a graph online showing that the backlog of road maintenance was £3.75 billion at the year 2000. And the report yesterday shows we're over £14 billion. It got worse by getting nearly £1.4 billion in the last 12 months. Mm. So I'd like to nominate the Secretary of State for Transport for Plank of the Week, who thinks that £200 million is going to touch the sides on a £14 billion backlog after being on television yesterday morning. The bloke doesn't know what he's talking about. He starts talking about...
He really doesn't. But, of course, the problem with potholes now is that there's more traffic on the roads than there's ever been. The traffic is heavier than it's ever been. The congestion is worse than it's ever been. And that must have an effect on it as well, right?
Yeah, and the age of the roads.
Yeah.
The average road's lifestyle, the wearing surface, is 20 to 30 years. It's now reported it's you can expect to have them resurfaced every 116 years. So doesn't take a lot of working out, Mike.
No. So what you're telling me is that terrible road that I have to drive on every Friday when I head out of sort of Deptford to get over towards Blackheath, I don't know if you know it, it's the road down to Greenwich. It is possibly the worst surface of any road I've ever driven on, and it's been under construction, roadworks, cones, those orange and white fences, literally for 5 years. 5 years they haven't finished the road.
Yes, I mean, you do wonder where our money's going that is going into it.
I mean, when you look at a council, I mean, is there any way for somebody, for example, depending on where they live, can you sort of ask a council how much they're spending on filling in potholes?
Yeah. You can freedom of information requests. And also, I think it's got to the stage where people are fed up and the roads are getting that bad. They're out of repair. And it's the piece in the Sun about your legal rights. And as you know, in the past, I've issued legal notices and threatened to issue them to get millions of pounds of resurfacing work carried out. Power back to the people,
right.
But government then find the money to repair the roads, or will they change the law?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I mean, they can find money when they need to find it, but they seem to be partly in a war against motorists at all times, despite the fact that they collect billions, tens of billions of pounds in fuel duty every year, 40 billion in road tax. You know, this is all money that's meant to be spent, surely to God, on the roads infrastructure, no?
Yeah, you'd think so, but they want to spend, you know, what's £100 billion plus on HS2 that now won't go into central London as much as they say it will.
Yeah.
It's, you know, Old Oak Common, as you know, to get into central London from there. Good luck with that journey. to somewhere in Birmingham, and the northern legs are getting cut off. Heathrow was cut off. Mm. I mean, they're just throwing money. I would stop that immediately and say first loss is the best loss. If we've lost 10 or 15 billion pounds, just don't plough more money into it.
No.
Spend some of that on our roads and also other things of the infrastructure, because roads are only a symptom of failure of investment over years in the country as a whole. You can't hide the state of the roads, and the public response has been horrendous in terms of yesterday, I think I finished my low social media response to people because I was inundated with things about midnight.
Mm. Ridiculous. Well, according to the piece you've got in the paper this morning, 13 million vehicles damaged every year because of highway defects. I was talking about this on the talk last night. You got a mention, you'll be pleased to know, because I said, you know, you've been campaigning for this for a very long time. But, you know, I've got, funnily enough, an email from my insurance company the other day just about pothole damage, because some people don't realise that some car insurance covers it, some other car insurance doesn't, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And also legal protection, because if you're fighting about damage to your car, if you've got some legal protection for your insurance, at least you have got a bit more sway. I think the insurance companies are becoming more interested because they see the potential. And I think it was 2.7 million vehicles are actually off the road as written potholes up till March for last year.
Yeah. Incredible. And worse than that, 52 cyclists killed or injured every single year, because it is a death trap, you know, for cyclists and also for motorcyclists as well. People on mopeds and all that. When you see a cyclist suddenly, you know, veer to the right or something in front of you in a car, you can't always stop. And many of them get involved in accidents because they're trying to avoid a pothole.
Yeah, I mean, it's atrocious in terms of those on 2-year wheels, because, you know, it doesn't just cost them the back pocket. It is that potential of kill or serious injury as a result of them. And, you know, government's pushing cycling healthiness, and that's great. That's why I try to not get away from this argument between road motorists and cyclists. While you're arguing, they ain't then taking it seriously. Collectively, as all road users, even pedestrians, I've come across cases where disabled people in wheelchairs have been thrown out of the wheelchairs because of potholes where people are on crossings and the like. So if we actually band together, perhaps it's time for government to realise. And I like the idea of issuing those notices, because it's not for a few odd potholes. If the road is that bad and you make a formal complaint, if they'd fail to do anything about it, you have got the rights under the current legislation to issue a legal notice. And with photographs and a bit of research, hold them to account. I'm sure they really don't want to go to court to defend it, because the magistrate would have to must possibly side with the person who's taken the case if you've got the evidence there.
Yeah, absolutely right. Is there any evidence, you think, to suggest that some of the more heavy vehicles now are causing more damage to the roads? You know, we know electric cars are a lot heavier, electric vans, electric buses, if there are any. Are they much heavier, and are they doing more damage to the roads?
Yeah, the potential load, because there's an immediate thing of power there, puts that load, transfer it to the wearing surface. You're quite right. Heavy goods vehicles are the equivalent of thousands of axles of a vehicle, but then they do pay an awful lot in duties and taxes. So, you know, and we rely on haulage. So you're quite right. So we've got perfect storm, lack of investment, decaying network, lack of funding to support it, heavier vehicles, more use of our vehicles, a bigger population, but government don't seem to understand that that is the blood supply for the UK economy. They're essential.
Almost as though all of these measures to reduce congestion in all of our cities don't work.
No, and also, in the future... In the future, the 15-minute local travel things, that's so you can't get out and see how bad the potholes are on the main roads, because you can't really go out there.
Right.
I mean, roll it forward, do we have hover vehicles at some point, or we won't probably have the energy to do so?
Yeah.
I mean, I just don't know where it's going to go. Yeah. I mean, unless they put in a long-term plan like places like Japan and do a 25-year investment in their roads, and it is resurfacing, and it's not it's a lot of money, but it's not in terms of the grand scheme of things when they've wasted, you know, untold billions, and they can find it down the back of the sofa when they want to.
It really is extraordinary. But listen, thanks for all the work that you do. I'm sure we'll get you on very shortly. How can people find your website, Mr. Pothole?
Don't have a website. I've got attacked so many times, Mike. On Twitter.
Got attacked? Why?
Yeah. I got such a big following and hit on there, particularly when I attacked HS2.
Right.
I had all sorts of things, and a friend of mine that knows far more about it said the code they'd used they hadn't seen, and that was someone who worked in Google. So I decided I'd just stick with social media.
Well, you're the only person that said to me, I'm on Twitter because I get less abuse when I go anywhere else. But there you go. First time for everything. Mr. Pothole, thank you very much indeed. Mark Morrell, he knows an awful lot about the appalling state of our roads. There's no question that this is another big and very important part of this country's psyche. People care about the right to drive. People care about the ability to get from point A to point B in a car without having to sit in traffic constantly, religiously, ridiculously, right? And again, all of the zealots, all of these kind of clean air, green, net zero zealots who want you to get out of your car and walk and cycle. Well, good luck doing that if you don't live in a city, because the only way you can get around is in a car. Trust me. I've been in lots of different parts of this country. You cannot get around unless you have your own car. It's that simple. But isn't it heartening to know that all the difficult and hard work of all of the people who want to reduce the amount of driving going on and who want to supposedly make the air cleaner, isn't it marvellous to see that all of their efforts are going absolutely and utterly nowhere? Because all that's happened since congestion charges were brought in, since ULEZ zones, ultra low emission zones were brought in and expanded, more and more people are driving, more and more roads are getting damaged. The cars, because they're greener, are now heavier, so they're damaging the roads even more. I wonder what effect that has on the environment. This is Talk TV.
Across the UK, online and on DAB, the Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
So if you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 to 1, Monday to Friday on Talk Radio, via DAB, online or via the Talk Radio app. If you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.